Feel like I just cleaned all the clutter off my desk, which I haven't done in my real life for years. All right, we return to Esther this morning, chapter 3, and we are seeing how God is working in a story where he doesn't appear, he doesn't speak, he's not even mentioned. So a lot like our lives, where God is at work even though we don't see him or hear him, don't always notice even that he's at work, yet he is. Chapter 3, verse 1. After these events, King Xerxes promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. All the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. The story of Esther is put together really well. I mean, admirably well. In fact, so much so that I sometimes get lost in the structure of the story, noticing how the storyteller moves it along. That's not supposed to happen. By the way, it's like watching a football game. You're not supposed to notice the refs. And when you do, they're too involved. It's the game being played on the field. And so with a story, it's the unfolding of the plot that you're supposed to notice, not the structural elements. And when the structural elements are doing their job, you usually don't notice. You get lost in the story. And the structural elements, I'm talking about the things that a storyteller uses to build suspense. What will happen next in our exciting story of Felix the Cat? To develop the plot, to give us ideas of the personalities of the various characters, and to engage the imagination. A good storyteller gets us there. You don't pay attention to how the story grabs you. You just go along with it. Sometimes we talk about suspending judgment if we're reading fiction. You just accept that in fiction things can happen that don't necessarily happen in real life. But every once in a while we have to slow down our reading and move close to the text and observe some of these structural elements, because otherwise we'll miss a deeper meaning that's there. It's so easy to read the surface and think that we've got it when the author intended something deeper. Or, more often than not, the author says more than he or she intended to say. And that happens a lot. I was talking to an author one time, and I said, you know, that one place where you said this, and I told him what I got out of it, and he said, I never thought of that. But you wrote it. But that's how it goes. I mean, that's happened a lot with me. People come up to me after I've spoken, and they said, you know, the thing that I liked most about what you said today, and then they tell me something. I never remember ever even saying it. And if I were to look at my notes, I can't find it. I mean, and I'm thinking, I didn't say that. You heard it, but I didn't say it. But if they really got something cool out of it, I say, well, thank you. But if they're offended, I say, I never said that. What are you thinking? Anyway, the storyteller, one of the structural elements here is that the storyteller will play characters against each other. We've already seen how Queen Vashti was replaced by Queen Esther. And now today's episode, I would title this Enter the Villain. And we will see how Haman is played against Mordecai. This episode begins after these events, which is a time stamp, though it's a vague one because it doesn't say how long after, but it's telling us basically time passed. And the Bible will do this frequently. Without this time stamp, knowing that the time passed, we would think that Haman appeared immediately after Esther became queen. If we put everything together that we find, we'll find out that it's been more like 4 years since she became queen. And so then Haman does not appear out of nowhere the way it looks like. There's a gap where things happened. You know, naturally, events were occurring in those 4 years, but for the storyteller, they're not to the point of the story. They're either not relevant or they're not crucial to the details that he or she wants to communicate. So in story time, Haman appears suddenly, and we're not told why the king gives him all this prestige and power and authority. So there must have been some kind of buildup that's not reported where Haman came to the king's attention and pleased him, you know, handled the affairs that he was given really well. But how he got there, again, isn't important to the storyteller. What matters is that he is there now, and his presence changes things, and not for the better. The next turn in the story will bring overwhelming crisis. Some of us live in a continual state of crisis. Some of us go through life, you know, fairly smooth things happen. Others of us hit periods of crisis, and when they do, it affects us the way it affects everyone else. What we see is that these time stamps, and there are a couple of them in this chapter, they're important. It's important to notice how time passes. Here, you know, 4 years go by in a blink. But time will slow down when Haman begins to engage his plot. We'll see how it slows down a lot. You see, crises affect our experience of time. In an emergency, 1,000 things can happen in a nanosecond. But in grief, sadness can make every tick of the clock last a lifetime. When you're deep in it, you think, I will not survive how sad I feel, because it seems like it's there forever. When is it going to lift? So it can be helpful for us to notice how time passes, how time is passing now, and to train ourselves to make adjustments so that we travel with time rather than become overrun by it. When it overruns us, we don't have time to catch our breath. When it overruns us, we don't pay attention to what it's doing to our mind and to our body or to our spirit, which sometimes completely loses contact with God when we need to have contact with him more than anything else. So I'll give you some hints to that later on, but just not right now. All right, so verse 3, then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, why are you transgressing the king's command? Now, it was when they had spoken daily to him and he would not listen to them that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Okay, first of all, I just want to say, Mordecai, if you'll recall, told his cousin Esther when she was in the beauty contest to become queen of Persia. He said, don't tell anyone who your people are. Don't let anyone know that you are a Jewess. And now here he's at the king's gate, and they say, why won't you bow down? He says, well, I'm a Jew. And it's okay for him to tell, but not her. See, because the male is wise and discerning and knows when he can say things, and the female has to obey the male. And she doesn't have the same way. I want you to see this, because it's not me making this up, or it's embedded in the culture of the time. And I want us to see this. I want us to see how this has been reinforced in this story. I think that it's possible that part of the purpose of the book of Esther is to break those stereotypes. A couple weeks ago, a guy posted on Facebook how his daughter spoke in their church and what a great job she did and how he was stirred by it, and other people commented on it. And he started getting blasted by these Christians who said women aren't supposed to speak in church. They're not supposed to teach. And so after a few days, he took the post down, and he said, I had to take that post down because so few people shared my joy. So I just put a little note there. Hey, I shared your joy, and I think it's wonderful what your daughter did. Without making comments about, you know, the other team, you know, which I wanted to, but, you know, you just don't want to, you know, hit that hornet's nest sometimes. But so anyway, it's very possible that, you see, it still needs to be chipped away in some quarters. You think, you know, we've made significant strides since the 60s and 70s and the rise of the feminist movement, but we haven't gotten all that far, really. All right, there are several ways to interpret what goes on here between Mordecai, the servants of the king, and Haman. One colorful possibility: when we read Mordecai's genealogy, we were told that he was from the tribe of Benjamin and that he was the son of two important names, and Shimei was one of them, and Kish was another. Kish was the father of King Saul, the first king of Israel. Shimei was this creep who followed David. David was running from Jerusalem because his son Absalom was revolting. And Shimei was also a descendant of Benjamin, of the family of Saul and Kish. And he walked on the top of the hills while David was making his exit, throwing rocks at David and those who were with him, and throwing dust into the air and cursing David and telling him, curse you for the blood that you shed, God's paying you back. And one of David's trusted soldiers said, David, it will not be any trouble for me at all to get up that hill and remove his head from his body. He's a dead dog. He should not be cursing you like this. And David said, let him go. You know, my own son's after me right now. How can I blame him for what he's doing? Maybe God will hear his curse and turn it into a blessing. Okay, so Mordecai, if we are to understand this, why are these specific names given? Well, we're to understand perhaps that he is connected to the house of Saul, first king of Israel. All right. Haman is an Agagite. I don't even know how that's pronounced. But he was possibly a descendant of Agag. That may be what that means. Now, I'm telling you, this is a colorful interpretation. It has a long tradition, and there are biblical scholars who still teach this today. And it fits the story well. And it gives an explanation as to why Mordecai would not bow and Haman would be so pissed. And it's this. When Israel came out of Egypt and were making their way to the Promised Land, along the way, a nation, the nation of Amalek, attacked them. The Amalekites came up behind them and started to kill off the stragglers. So Moses stopped the camp, put Joshua in charge of their armed forces, and they went to battle against Amalek. It was a big deal because Moses was up on a hillside, and as long as his arms were in the air, Israel won. When his arms got too tired and started to drop, the Amalekites began to win. After the battle, and then he had helpers holding his hands up the rest of the day. After the battle, God said, I'm done with the Amalekites. I'm going to blot them out of existence. And he said, Moses, write this in a book. Make a record of this. that I am against the Amalekites from generation to generation. All right. Once Israel had a king, King Saul, the son of Kish. Once they had a king, the prophet Samuel went to him and said, God has put you in charge of carrying out his grudge against the Amalekites. Go and wipe them out. Don't spare anything. Not even the animals. Don't spare anything. Just try to set aside, for the time being, our concerns for ethnic cleansing and, you know, how this strikes us today. These were very barbaric times, and this is what they understood God to be saying. So Saul led his troops against the Amalekites, but, oh, you know, they've got some mighty fine head of cattle and some really healthy sheep. Let's just kill off the sick sheep and the sickly cattle, but save the best for ourselves. They did what they were not supposed to do. And he spared King Agag, the king of the Amalekites. If Mordecai is a descendant of King Saul, and Haman is a descendant of King Agag, then they have brought this ancient feud to Persia. And it's personal. This is family against family. It's not just nation against nation. This is family. This is the Hatfields and the McCoys, you know, moving to L.A. and still shooting at each other. Okay, so that's one possibility. Like I said, it's very colorful. I think it's a stretch myself, but it's kind of a fun one to play with. The storyteller delays in giving Mordecai's reason for why he's not bowing. And maybe he has to think it over, or maybe he just doesn't want to give it. I don't know. But then the storyteller says it's because he told them that he was a Jew. That's why he didn't bow. And that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Abraham bowed before other people. I mean, it goes back that far. And from that time, there were other people of God and Jews who bowed before human rulers and had no problem with that. It was a way of showing respect. If you were sitting in a room full of people and a dignitary walked in, it would be respectful and polite to stand up. If you're in a courtroom, you're going to stand up, or the bailiff's going to knock you on the head with his nightstick. It is how we show respect. We stand up. They would bow. So it really doesn't explain why he refused to bow. But we can imagine that it could be his convictions. He could have strong convictions about being in this pagan land. I'm not going to bow to any pagan authority. It may indicate a stubbornness, like his ancestor Shimei, who was very disrespectful to David. You know, it's like, just try to make me. But if it is his conviction, it put a whole nation in harm's way. So, you know, I don't want to like go through this and just find fault with Mordecai. You just have to wonder. That's all I'm doing. I wonder. Verse 5. Where am I? When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. Once informed, Haman began to look for Mordecai, and he saw that this Jew was not bowing. And his reaction to not being honored was that he was filled with rage. Now, this reaction is characteristic of people who are personality disordered. There's a class of personality disorders, class B, and this would include narcissistic personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, and borderline personality disorder. There's one other, histrionic. These are the people who say, I will not be ignored. if they feel like they've been slighted, if they feel like they haven't gotten the respect they deserve, they can get very, very nasty. And the person who gets honored, they can come up with the most horrible things about them to say. And I think that their philosophy is, if you throw enough mud, maybe some of it will stick. They cannot stand. Antisocial personality disorder cannot stand to hear other people praise someone else. The narcissist has trouble with that. And I bring this up, well, I'll explain why in a little bit. These people with these personality disorders are capable of doing great injury to others. I mean, it's unimaginable the things that they can come up with and how they can get people in trouble with the law, how they can destroy their property and get away with it. These people are sometimes the stalkers who, if I can't have you, no one can have you. And then there are the people who live in contemptuous relationships with their husband or wife. I hate you, don't leave me, is the tagline of the borderline. We have seen already in Esther how anger drives the plot in both chapters 1 and 2. And here again, anger now is driving the plot. And it motivates Haman to plan an extreme payback. He doesn't just want to see Mordecai hang. He wants to see all the Jews, all of Mordecai's people, his people, scattered throughout the realm of Persia. He wants to see them all destroyed. And do you remember in chapter 1, it was Queen Vashti who offended the king? And his counselor said, well, we need to teach all our women a lesson. Same kind of extreme reaction. We're not just going to punish Vashti. Let's put all women in their place. And it's the same kind of thing here. It's extreme. Verse 7. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Xerxes, Pur, that is, Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, that is the month of Adar. This is where the plot slows down. And here we have another time stamp, right? Here we have calculated time. He's timing an event. Beginning the first day of the first month, every day he has the lot cast. Let's say they roll the dice for him to see if this is an auspicious day to go to the king with his accusation against the Jews. He's looking for the best day to hit up the king to kill the Jews. Haman, then, is using divination. The casting of lots was a very common form of divination at that time. And he has counselors who are doing this for him. They're not mentioned. We're just told that the lot was cast before him. The Hebrew says they cast the lot before him. So it's in his presence. He's ordering this. We're not told who all is there, but we'll find out later. And his wife is among his counselors. She seems to be a smart lady and very insightful and prescient. So every morning they get together and they roll the dice. Nope, not today. Nope, not today. They do this all 12 months of the year. And then finally, at some point in that 12th month, the dice rolls up snake eyes or double sixes or whatever it is, and they go, okay, today's the day. Right? Now, while this is going on, he's plotting, and then when the day comes, he's implementing this scheme. The Jews know nothing of this. They don't know how this sword is hanging over their heads. They don't know how their doom has already been determined. So they can't make any objection to it. They cannot make any appeal. They don't have the clout in Persia to take legal steps to defend themselves. they have been turned into victims of Haman's hatred and of the fact that he's close enough to the king to have the power and authority to make this happen, to end their existence, at least in Persia. Verse 8. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasuries." It's been estimated that the amount of silver he was volunteering was like 3 tons. Then the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, "The silver is yours, and the people also, do with them as you please." Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written just as Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, and to the princes of each people, each province according to its script, each people according to its language, being written in the name of King Xerxes and sealed with the king's signet ring. The signet ring was like your John Hancock today, your signature on a contract. It was usually stamped in clay or wax. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate. Wow, it's not enough just to chop their heads off with a sword. No, we're going to destroy, we're going to kill, we're going to annihilate. And after that, we're going to kick them in the shins. So, what is why pile up all these words? It's just to say they intend to carry out this full program of complete destruction. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. A copy of the edict to be issued as law in every province was published to all the peoples so that they should be ready for this day. And be ready, be prepared. I see these guys sitting out in front of their house, you know, and they've got their foot on the pedal that's spinning the wheel, and they're sharpening their knives on it, and they're looking at their Jewish neighbors, and they're just, you know, smirking at them, or they're just giving them these sinister looks. They've got to be prepared for this day. Haman has presented his case to King Xerxes. A certain people, notice he doesn't specify the ethnicity of the people. It's possible if he says, look, these Jews living here, well, there are lots of Jews who are living in that capital city. And who knows, but the king's favorite confectionaries came from their bakeries, or, you know, who knows what services they provided. Haman's careful about that. There's a certain people, you know, I'm not saying who, I'm just saying that they're scattered all throughout your kingdom, and oh boy, are they trouble. Okay, they're everywhere, and their laws are different. You know, that particular point about the Jews was used against them a lot during this time. In the book of Ezra, letters are written to, at that time, I forget which king of Persia it was, saying, you need to look at these people and their history. These have been a rebellious people. They're not like others. Same thing in the book of Daniel. It's the differences that belonging to Yahweh, the God of Israel, made in their lives that set them apart. Well, in a pagan world where the Jews had no nation state, or home any longer to define them, they found their identity in the law of God. This told them who they were. And it made them unique. And that prevented them from melting in to the cultures where they had been exiled. That prevented them from losing their identity as the chosen people of God. They were able to maintain a loyalty to Yahweh, their God, because they had his law. They did not have the temple. They did not have the promised land. All that was taken from them, but they still had the law. So that became the centerpiece of their faith, which is the strength of their identity through this period of time, and it's their weakness when we get to the New Testament times and Jesus, because God was offering them a new identity through his Son. Okay, so, yeah, they were distinct from the other nations. God made this distinction when he called Israel. He said, I will separate you from all the other nations. You will be my peculiar people. You will be my treasured people. And I will be your God. And the idea was not just that Israel be set apart to God and, you know, be better than everyone else. The idea was through Israel, then God would reach the rest of the world. He would create a model people, and they would draw others to their God. So he gave them this unique identity. There's also a Christian identity and a certain Christian nonconformity. Paul said, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of the mind. And there are all kinds of influences in our world we don't want to have our lives conformed to. On the other hand, it's not about nonconformity. It's not about us making ourselves different. If we set out, I can tell you this, because this is where I grew up, in the religious subculture I grew up in. If we set out to make ourselves different from others, we only succeed in making ourselves weird. And then people say, what is with those weirdos who dress in time warp fashion, you know, whose values are time warp, whose thinking is, you know, somewhere in the past, if not the past, the twilight zone, you know, who are these strange people? And there are some religious people who have made themselves self-righteous, but we're not like others. You know, we don't do this and we don't do that. And when anyone looks at them, they don't see righteousness, they don't see goodness, they don't see holiness, they simply see strangeness. And I don't think that's anything we want to excel in, you know what I mean? I have enough problems with that as it is already, just, you know, who I am. I don't need to add to it. It's like my strangeness has nothing to do with God's work in my life, everything with his unfinished business in me. Anyway, that is a reaction against culture rather than a response to God. And there's no good reason to react against culture, because as soon as we make culture the enemy, we exclude ourselves from the dialogue. We have no business being part of the conversation if we stand outside of culture criticizing it. And God does not stand outside of culture. He doesn't tiptoe around culture or paganism. He always inserts himself right in the middle of every human social environment, because that was why he created us. He wants us, and he draws us and brings us to himself. So Haman with the king says, if it is pleasing, and this is another element that turns the plot in the first chapter, if it is pleasing to the king, let's go with this plan. And here he says, if it's pleasing to the king, here's how we can resolve this problem. And the king takes his signet ring off his finger and he gives it to Haman. So now the authority, the highest authority of Persia, is in the hands of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. It's scary. This is written and published in all the languages spoken in the kingdom. And not only are these people by command of the king to participate in killing off the Jews, but they are also to go in and seize their plunder. This was to take everything. That's an added incentive, isn't it? Well, you know, I don't really have anything against the Jews, but I do like some of their beautiful artwork hanging in their homes. I do want what's in their bank account. And a lot of that went from Nazi Germany to Switzerland, huh? And Switzerland is in like, I think there's probably $2 billion left of their indebtedness that they still owe to the Jews who suffered those kinds of losses during the Holocaust. So history repeats itself, at least what almost happened here. Everyone's to prepare for this day. Climax of the chapter, verse 15. The couriers went out, impelled by the king's command, while the decree was issued at the citadel in Susa, while the king and Haman sat down to drink. The city of Susa was in confusion. We're left in suspense for now as to what happens next. And like the city of Susa, perhaps we're a little confused also. How could this happen? Why would God even allow this? Why would evil Haman get so far? I can tell you that for the Jews at that time, they were looking at the end of their existence. No one in the family was spared or safe. And why did God let it go to this extent? And the king and Haman, they're off drinking again. The king drinks a lot, and he makes bad decisions when he drinks, and he has a tendency to lose his anger more when he drinks. But why does he drink? Well, he can. He's the king. You know, he can do whatever he wants. But I don't think that's why anyone drinks or uses. I know at least one therapist, and I'm sure that there are more, one therapist who will not talk about addiction anymore. She talks about self-medication. So the question is, if you're in recovery, what are you medicating? Because if you just get sober, that's not a good enough reason to go through recovery. You know, people who, for the rest of their lives, are saying, I'm maintaining my sobriety. Well, wonderful, but you know, recovery isn't for maintaining sobriety, it's for living a fuller life. And that fuller life may require that you deal with issues. And they're the very issues your mind does not want to face. They're issues that have been retained in your nervous system and your body. Your nervous system remembers and still reacts. It blows up, it panics, it runs and hides, it fights, it drinks or uses. Because it can't cope with the overwhelming emotions that come up, with a sense of fear or failure, or it's too much, I can't do it, I can't handle it. I just want to feel good again. I want that instant good feeling. But there's a better way, there's a better life. I talked to a woman yesterday, you know, the memorial service for Tim Eba was yesterday. And this woman came up to me afterwards, and I didn't recognize her, but she said, I was here in the same room years ago on a Thursday night, and you were teaching, not the same room, but where the service was. And she said, at the end of the service, you said, and it was something like this, God wants to free you who have a problem with drugs. And she said, and I thought to myself, phew, I don't have a problem with drugs. I'm just an alcoholic. And she said, and you paused and said, and or alcohol. And she said, I knew then that you were talking to me. And she said, I went for prayer that night, and I never used again. Now, I don't know very many people who can say that, but it was pretty cool to hear, because I thought, wow, you know, this is possible. She said, now, I've told my story, and that's her story. I've told my story in many different places, and it brings hope to those who hear it because of what you said that night. So the king is drinking again. There are reasons why we drink, and sometimes the reason is because of what was forced on us by someone like Haman, someone with a personality disorder, someone who cannot help but mistreat us. And what they did to us caused us now to want to run and hide or to get away from them, to get away from the pain, from the mirror, from the self-loathing, from whatever it is that is still inside of us, that sense of unworthiness. You know, the sad thing is, there are people that I admire so much who are caught up in addiction, and it doesn't matter how many times I tell them, no, you are worth something. Oh, but I never even got my degree, and I'm not making much money. And I said, I'm not talking about that. That doesn't make you something. You are already something. You don't know how valuable you are. And I can see it. I can see this is a good person. This is someone you want to see, you know, overcome these things and get well. But they can't see it for themselves, and they can't hear it from me. Now, and I wish they could. So anyway, this is where I'm going with this today. There was a partial truth in Haman's accusation, and that's how it always is. There's partial truth in those who attack us. The Jews were different. They belonged to Yahweh, but they were not a threat. In fact, long ago, God had made a promise to Abraham and his descendants. He says, whoever blesses you, I will bless. Whoever curses you, I will curse. And the Jews were always a blessing to their community and to their society. And they were in Persia. So he completely misrepresented them, though he did tell a partial truth. It was their difference that made them a blessing. But this is how personality disordered people operate. They operate in the dark, you know, what you don't know. They use generalizations. They use outright lies. They don't have any problem with that. I spoke with a woman this week, and it's partly why my mind's so on this. I had communication with her a while back, which I don't remember, and I think it's probably just age-related. But I had a conversation with her, I think it was by email, and she kind of laid out what was going on with her and a close relative. And I wrote back and I said, this sounds like borderline personality disorder. I'm not a psychologist and I cannot make that diagnosis, but there are patterns that sometimes, you know, give indications. And I said, if that's so, this is going to get a whole lot worse. Now, she was looking for the preacher to give her a quick fix, you know, oh, God will bless you, you know, be well, be gone. But I didn't have that kind of a message for her. I did not see light on the horizon. And I said, this is very likely to get worse. Well, she got in touch with me this last week, and she said, you were right. It's become a freak show. It's horrible. I went to court last week, and they told all kinds of lies. They brought documentation of supposed things that I had done, and she said, my lawyer was stunned like a deer in the headlights and did not know how to respond to this stuff. And so she said, is it possible for us to meet at all this week? And I met with her. I don't know how much good it did. But there are these people out there. And I'll tell you, one temptation that comes up right away is, well, I'm going to give them a dose of their own medicine. I'm going to find a way to make them miserable. And you probably can't do that. First of all, they're very miserable already, and they're trying to discharge some of that misery by putting it on other people. And it might soothe them for a little while. I call it a thumb-sucking exercise. It might soothe them for a little while if they rage on you, but it doesn't make them really feel any better in the long run. They go right back to their distress, their internal distress. But if you try to play their game, you're going to lose, because they're just too good at it. They've been doing it their whole lives. And there's a line you won't cross because you have a conscience. They don't have a conscience. And so they cross lines. They would do things you wouldn't even think of doing to them. You cannot win if you play their game. And the best thing you can do is cut your losses and split. Live as far away from them as possible. The second best thing is use whatever the law avails, but let the law be between you and them always. And then get a good security system. Normal people cannot understand this behavior. When someone slanders someone to you and it just sounds like, so-and-so did that? How could so-and-so be guilty of that? Wow. They assume, well, there must be some truth to it or they wouldn't say it. But these people are not like that. They'll say it even knowing that it's a bold-faced lie. They cross that line without breaking a sweat. It happens, and when it does, when it happens, when you realize you're a victim of someone like this, you need to notice how time flows for you. Because it seems to speed up. Everything's happening at once. The whole sky is coming down all at once. You need to slow that down and slow yourself down and have or make breathing spaces. A breathing space is when you inhale slowly and exhale slowly. You take control of your breath, which is a way to take control of the passage of time. And then you let your prefrontal cortex have a little conversation with your brainstem. Or, if you read the Bible and you like the Psalms, you talk to your soul. And you say, "Return to your rest, O my soul, for the Lord has been good to you." In other words, you use your rational mind as it becomes aware of these things to talk to your autonomic nervous system, which has gone into fight or flight mode, the sympathetic mode, and you say, "Relax." And think about that. I want you to think for a moment that you're talking to your brainstem, which has been activated, it's been triggered, you know, and maybe you know some of the triggers that, you know, set you off. It's been triggered, and it's going, "Hyper, oh man, I just want to go get loaded right now," or kill somebody or something, maybe something legal, but file a lawsuit. But you know, you're all triggered. Imagine talking to that part of your brain and saying, "Calm down. Calm down. And I'm going to tell you why. Why? How? And let me give you a verse. God says, 'Behold, I myself have created the smith who blows the fire of coals and brings out a weapon for its work. And I have created the destroyer to ruin. No weapon that is formed against you will prosper. And every tongue that accuses you in judgment, you will condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their vindication is from me, declares the Lord.'" That's what you can tell yourself. No weapon formed against you will prosper. Hey, you might get a puncture wound, you might get a laceration. That happens, and the soul feels that. But God says, "This is not going to do you in, because I'm with you, and I have the power over all these things. I created the blacksmith who fires up the coals, and from it creates the weapon. and no weapon formed against you is going to succeed. Return to your rest, O my soul. The Lord is good to you. Would you stand with me, please? And now, may the Lord bless us. Keep away all evil and lead us into eternal life. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.